Have you ever spent like hours trying to fix a problem or even
Oh,
days?
absolutely. We all have.
Right. And you're just pulling your hair out over this massive complex issue only to realize the root cause was painfully simple, like a loose cable.
Or a plug that just wasn't pushed into the wall all the way.
Yes. You build this whole elaborate theory about what's broken, but the truth is just sitting there, right on the floor.
It's a very universal human experience, really. I mean, we inherently want to believe that complex symptoms must have complex causes. We see a massive system failure, and we just assume the architecture itself is flawed.
And in the world of enterprise IT, that assumption doesn't just cost people their sanity, it costs millions of dollars in downtime.
Definitely.
So today we are going into a really fascinating field guide from WUC Technologies. It's written by their senior principal engineer, Steve O'Brien.
Right, and it's titled The OSI Model as Incident Response Framework.
Which I know on the surface sounds like we are about to read a networking textbook from 1984.
Yeah, it does sound a bit dry at first glance.
Right, the OSI model is that classic seven-layer diagram every IT student memorizes for a certification exam and then, immediately forgets.
Almost instantly.
But the mission of our deep dive today is to completely transform how you view that boring diagram. We're going to look at how turning the OSI model into a high-stakes, real-world triage taxonomy can literally cut hours off enterprise downtime. Okay, let's unpack this. Because the core argument here completely flips how most people think about troubleshooting.
Yeah, the core thesis Steve O'Brien presents is that infrastructure degradation almost always masquerades as application instability.
Wait, masquerades? Like it's hiding.
Exactly. When a system breaks, the alarm bells always ring at the very top of the stack, at the application layer. But the actual fire is usually burning several layers below, down in the physical or network infrastructure.
So we're talking about why IT teams waste like the first 90 minutes of a major incident because they trust the initial alarm.
Right. And the source argues that the alarm is essentially lying to them.
Just lying straight to their faces.
Pretty much. And this illustrates the danger of top-down troubleshooting. Let's say an alert fires. The dashboard says a critical application, maybe a database or a web portal, is unreachable.
Okay, so a major outage.
Yeah. And the intuitive human response is to look at the application. Did we just deploy new code? Is the database healthy? Is the load balancer overloaded?
I mean, that makes sense. If your car's engine light comes on, you look at the engine, you don't immediately check if the asphalt on the road is chemically sound.
It's a great analogy. But in IT infrastructure, that top-down instinct is actually a trap. Every layer of technology is built on the assumption that the layer beneath it is perfectly reliable.
Right, it trusts the foundation.
Exactly. So when that foundation cracks, the layers above don't know how to interpret the failure. They just panic. The guide provides this brilliant breakdown of cascade propagation.
Walk us through that. What does a cascade look like in practice?
So imagine a physical host bus adapter, an HBA, at the very bottom of the stack, layer one. It starts dropping data frames. Just a minor hardware degradation like a physical stutter.
Okay, so what happens next? Does the system just immediately flag the broken hardware?
Not at all. The SCSI driver sitting directly above that hardware is designed to be resilient. It silently retransmits those dropped frames.
Wait, silently so it doesn't tell anyone?
Yeah, it doesn't throw a critical error. It just assumes there was a momentary blip and tries again. Then the hypervisor sitting above the driver notices all these retries and records a spike in input-output latency.
Which means the virtual machine sitting on the hypervisor suddenly feels that latency.
Right.
It thinks its virtual hard disk is running slow.
You hit the nail on the head, and it continues up the chain. The database running inside that virtual machine experiences query timeouts because it just can't write data fast enough.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. So finally, the application waiting on the database just throws a generic 5xx server error.
And the end user gets a spinning wheel on their screen, gets completely frustrated, and files a support ticket that just says the app is broken. It's literally the telephone game. The physical hardware at the bottom whispers, I dropped a frame. And by the time that message passes through five layers of software abstraction, the application is screaming, the database is on fire.
What's fascinating here is the asymmetric cost of time. This dynamic is exactly why WUC advocates for bottom-up troubleshooting.
Because it's faster.
Way faster.
Huh.
Disproving layer one, checking the physical hardware, the optical power levels, the error counters on the switch ports, takes a trained engineer about 30 minutes.
That's nothing compared to a massive outage window.
Exactly. But if you start at the top, trying to disprove the application logic, the database queries, and the software layers first, That takes 4 to 8 hours. You literally spend an entire shift chasing ghosts.
That is terrifying when every minute of downtime costs thousands of dollars. So if the symptoms at the top are lying to us, the methodology dictates we have to look at the physical truth at the bottom, layers 1 and 2.
Which brings us to the physical reality of data centers.
Right. And the physical layer is surprisingly vulnerable to the real world. Mm-hmm. In fact, the guide has this great joke about layer 0.
Yes. Layer 0. That's the physical environment itself. The HVAC system, the ambient temperature of the room, the humidity.
There is a case study in the guide about a WUC client with intermittent connectivity issues, like a system that just sometimes worked.
Those are the worst to troubleshoot.
Oh, absolutely. The engineers were probably tearing apart application code, analyzing network traffic patterns, going completely down the rabbit hole.
And what was it?
The root cause was a patch panel cross connect that worked perfectly at 68 degrees Fahrenheit. But when the building's HVAC system shifted the room temperature to 78 degrees, the metal in the connector physically expanded just enough to unseat the cable. It physically disconnected.
That is wild. It serves as such a stark reminder of how the physical world intrudes on the digital one. They shared another case regarding a bent fiber optic cable that was really similar.
Oh, right. The cleanup incident.
Yeah. During a routine cleanup, someone bent a fiber cable just slightly past its minimum bend radius. Not enough to snap the glass inside, but enough to cause a micro bend.
Just a tiny kink in the cable.
Right. And for months, the system was totally fine. But then the application started slowing down exclusively during business hours.
See, if you're managing an application and it slows down only during the day, your immediate assumption is user load.
Naturally. You assume more people are logging in, so the servers are struggling.
But it wasn't the servers.
No, the telemetry told a completely different story. Thermal expansion during the day was causing the outer jacket of the cable to shift slightly. That tiny shift applied pressure to the microbend, altering the angle of the light bouncing through the glass.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it pushed the optical power level past its lowest threshold. The data was literally struggling to physically pass through the bent glass, but only when the sun was up and the building was warm.
Wait, I have to push back here. We have multi-million dollar observability platforms now. Shouldn't the network switch just trigger an alert saying, hey, my cable is bent, or my connector is expanding?
You would think so.
Why are engineers flying blind to physical physics?
Well, it goes back to the architectural limitations of a network switch. A switch's command line interface, its internal logic, generally only knows if the link state is completely up or completely down.
So it's binary, on or off.
Exactly. What happens in the physical space between the switch port and the host port is largely invisible to the switch's standard operating system.
It has no idea what the cable is doing.
Right. The switch thinks everything is fine because electrical current or light is technically still flowing. It takes specialized optical telemetry to actually see that the signal is degrading before it fails entirely.
And that blindness extends to layer 2 as well, the data link layer. There's a scenario here where a new department was set up. The workstations could reach the internet, but they couldn't reach any internal company servers.
Let me guess, they blamed the firewall.
Of course. Three engineers spent 90 minutes ripping apart the firewall, assuming it was some complex security block.
When in reality, the access switch ports for that new department were simply assigned to the wrong virtual LAN, the wrong VLAN.
Just a typo.
It was a one-line configuration error at layer 2, because they started troubleshooting at the top, looking at layer 7 firewall policies and security rules. They wasted an hour and a half trying to fix a foundation that wasn't properly mapped.
So if the physics of the glass and copper are sound, the pulses of light are making it across, but those pulses still need a map. They have to know how to navigate the maze of routers.
Which brings us logically to layer 3, the network layer, and layer 4, the transport layer.
This is where silent traffic drops absolutely destroy performance.
Absolutely. Layer 3 is all about IP routing. It is frequently the layer everyone tends to blame first when things get weird. Mm-hmm. The classic example in the guide involves a cloud virtual machine that booted up perfectly.
Sounds normal so far.
The operating system was healthy, the internal application was running, but it could not reach the internet at all.
Once again, the team assumes it is a massive cloud infrastructure failure. They're checking security groups, network address translation gateways, complex routing tables.
And there's a one-line metadata on the machine itself, the default gateway, you know, the specific IP address the machine uses to talk to the outside world, was set to the network address instead of the gateway address.
Wow.
Yeah, if you can't leave your own driveway, it doesn't matter how clear the highway is.
But layer 4 is where the mechanisms get truly insidious. This is the transport layer dealing with TCP and UDP protocols. The guide highlights a TCP congestion collapse.
Oh, this is a great one.
Yeah. There was a backup job that suddenly started taking four times longer than normal to finish. What is the actual mechanism causing that slowdown?
It is a beautiful example of how robust protocols can actually mask underlying failures. Mm. There was a single port on an access layer switch that was physically degrading at the microchip level. It was dropping roughly every 50,000th data frame.
Which doesn't sound like a lot.
For normal web browsing, it isn't. TCP is designed to handle packet loss gracefully. It notices a dropped frame, silently requests a retransmission, and the human at the keyboard never even notices the millisecond delay.
A backup job isn't normal web browsing, though. It's a massive, sustained fire hose of data.
Exactly. When that continuous fire hose of data hits a port dropping every 50,000th frame, TCP's built-in congestion avoidance algorithms totally panic.
Because it thinks the network is full.
Right. TCP assumes that packet loss means the network highway is congested. Too much traffic. So it triggers something called a fast retransmit and then drastically shrinks its transmission window to be safe. It artificially throttles its own speed.
So it slows down, realizes the network isn't actually congested, speeds back up, hits another hardware drop frame, and slams on the brakes again.
It is a constant cycle of accelerating and slamming on the brakes. The entire backup process crawls to a halt, not because the network is busy, but because TCP is misinterpreting a dying microchip as traffic congestion.
If you are dealing with massive data transfers, that underlying logic is crucial to understand. And speaking of data transfers, we have to talk about the SAN fabric outlier, storage area networks.
Oh, the storage blind spot.
Yes. The guide points out that fiber channel fabrics are a massive blind spot because Ethernet engineers just aren't trained to look at them.
Fiber channel is a totally different topology. It is designed for lossless transport between servers and storage arrays. Ethernet assumes dropped packets are fine because TCP will clean up the mess. Storage protocols cannot drop a block of data or you corrupt the hard drive.
It's a huge difference.
It is. The WUC team diagnosed an issue where a transceiver, an SFP Plus module, was intermittently failing on a massive Cisco MDS director switch. It would carry traffic for a few minutes, drop out, recover, and drop out again.
And let me guess, the Ethernet network engineers saw absolutely nothing wrong on their dashboards. Everything looked green.
Yep. Perfectly green.
Why is it disconnect?
Because the failure wasn't happening on the Ethernet network. When that fiber channel port dropped, the storage stack's multipath logic kicked in to reroute the storage traffic to a backup path. But that failover timeout takes between 8 and 30 seconds.
Oh, that's an eternity in computing time?
Right. During that gap, the application is trying to write data and it just hangs. The application sees massive storage degradation. But unless you have specific telemetry tapping into the separate fiber channel fabric, the Ethernet side is completely blind to it.
So the application just looks like it's randomly falling asleep for 30 seconds at a time.
Remish.
The physical cables are fine, the routing is fine, the storage is technically fine, but the user still can't log in. Why? Because the data has navigated the maze and arrived at layer 5 and layer 6, session and presentation.
The blurry modern stack.
Exactly. And modern security protocols are incredibly fragile here.
The guide notes that in modern architectures, the strict 1984 boundaries of the OSI model blur significantly here. Identity, encryption, and API calls kind of span across these layers. But treating layers 5 and 6 as diagnostic lenses remains incredibly effective for troubleshooting.
Take layer 5, the session layer, single sign-on or SSO. It's something you probably use every single day to get into your work application.
Oh yeah, constantly.
The guide details a Kerberos clock skew failure. If the internal clock on a user's workstation and the server's clock drift apart by more than 5 minutes, which is the default tolerance, by the way, the entire SSO process silently fails.
It operates as a strict security mechanism to prevent replay attacks. If a malicious actor intercepts an authentication ticket, they might try to use it later.
Like using a stolen ticket for a concert the next day.
Exactly. To prevent this, the ticket has a timestamp. If the server receives a ticket and its internal clock is, say, 6 minutes ahead of the workstation's clock, the server assumes the ticket is from the past, flags it as invalid, and drops it.
And the frustrating part is that the failure is often completely silent to the user.
Totally silent. The logs don't explicitly scream, the clock is wrong. You just see a generic authentication rejection.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Layer 6, the presentation layer, handles encryption. There was a major payment gateway that started rejecting every single financial transaction at exactly 03.000 UTC on a Sunday.
The application logs were incredibly vague, simply stating TLS handshake failed.
Right. And the root cause was an expired TLS security certificate. But the kicker is the human element of why it expired. They had a robust monitoring system designed to catch this exact issue.
What went wrong?
3 months prior, an engineer had muted the certificate alert because it was being too noisy during some routine tuning process.
Oh, no.
Yep. One muted notification 3 months ago resulted in a massive financial outage on a Sunday morning.
That human element transitions us perfectly to the very top of the stack. Layer 6 failed technically, but a human decision 3 months prior caused it. We finally arrive at Layer 7, the application layer, and the infamous unofficial Layer 8.
Layer 8, the danger zone.
Hmm.
For those unfamiliar with the term, Layer 8 is the political layer.
Yes, it is.
It's the organizational silos. It is the mandatory bridge call with 50 people where every single department network, database, application storage looks at their own dashboard, sees green lights, and firmly states, not my issue.
This is where the stakes are the absolute highest. WC shared an incredible case study involving Epic. For context, Epic is the dominant electronic health record system in the U.S., managing data for hundreds of millions of patients.
So if Epic goes down, a hospital's clinical operations effectively stall.
Exactly. So picture this. It is midweek, middle of an active clinical day. An engineering team deploys a new update to an authentication service that sits in front of Epic.
And let me guess, things broke.
Immediately. Every clinician trying to log in gets an HTTP 500 error. Doctors, nurses, pharmacists, they are entirely locked out of patient charts, medication orders, critical care protocols.
The pressure in that scenario is just unimaginable.
Yeah.
Every passing minute has severe potential patient safety implications.
Absolutely.
Do they start a massive layer 1 to 7 diagnostic hunt to figure out the code error? No. They rolled back the deployment in under 5 minutes. They restored clinical access immediately, and then they did the root cause analysis the following Monday.
That is the crucial operational lesson for Layer 7. When a deployment correlates with a critical application failure, especially in a life safety or high stakes financial environment, you roll back first and diagnose later.
Makes total sense.
You do not attempt to read new code or debug logic while a clinical floor is paralyzed.
Right. And it turns out it was just a missing variable in the production secrets manifest. It didn't show up in testing because the staging environment used a completely different setup.
Of course.
But this brings us to WUC's ultimate defensive strategy against Layer 8 politics and human error. They call it the two-engineer rule.
The two-engineer rule is a brilliant operational methodology designed specifically to defeat anchoring bias.
Anchoring bias.
Yeah. When an engineer gets paged at 2 a.m., they naturally form a hypothesis in the first 5 minutes based on whatever dashboard they see first. Human nature dictates that they will spend the next hour subconsciously trying to prove their initial hypothesis right, even if the surrounding data suggests they are wrong.
They anchor to their first idea.
That's exactly. So to combat that, WUC puts two engineers on the incident simultaneously. One engineer starts at layer one, checking physical cables, optical power, storage telemetry, and systematically works their way up the stack.
Okay, bottom up.
The second engineer starts at layer seven, checking recent deployments, application logs, end-to-end traces, and works their way down.
And they meet in the middle.
Yes. They require status updates from each other every 10 minutes. The golden rule of this methodology is absolutely no theories can be presented without hard telemetry evidence to back them up.
So you can't just guess.
Right. You don't get to say, I think it's the firewall. You must say, here is the log showing the firewall dropping the packet.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the longest mean time to resolutions, the massive outages that last for 8 hours and make the nightly news, they rarely end up being highly complex technical mystery.
No, they're organizational standoffs.
Exactly. The two-engineer rule, using the OSI model as a structured map, completely cuts through the layer 8 politics. You cannot say, not my issue, when an engineer is walking up the stack with hard data in hand, systematically ruling out every system until they reach yours.
The telemetry-first approach means teams aren't arguing about opinions or gut feelings. They are correlating data across the entire infrastructure. It shifts the entire IT culture from a reactive, defensive blame game into a proactive, predictive science.
So, what does this all mean? It means the OSI model isn't just an outdated diagram used to pass a test. When you apply it to the chaos of a collapsing enterprise system, it becomes a defensive strategy.
A very effective one.
It is a way to conquer human bias, panic, and our natural instinct to look for complex answers to simple problems. It forces you to prove the foundation is solid before you start tearing the roof apart.
I think there is a profound implication here regarding how we build the future. We are currently living in an era of massive abstraction. We build serverless architectures and rely on AI-driven orchestration to handle the underlying infrastructure, so we never really have to think about it.
Right, it's all just in the cloud.
But as we push further into abstracting away the bottom four layers of the stack to make things easier, we might be engineering away our own ability to troubleshoot. If you hide the physical and network layers behind a slick interface, what happens when the physics of a bent fiber cable finally break your system and you no longer possess the map to find it?
That is a phenomenal question to ponder. As we build systems that are too complex for any one human to intuitively understand, classic frameworks like the OSI model might be the only tethers we have left to the physical reality of our data. Sometimes, before you query the AI and debug the cloud architecture, you just need to walk down to the basement and check if the cable is actually plugged in. Thank you for joining us on this custom deep dive. We'll catch you next time.